Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A friend of mine once told me she thought old people past a certain age, if they are really sick, have a duty to die. Not a right to die, a duty to die. Let's have a family meeting, an intergenerational conversation about death. I imagine it would be a massively threatening thought for many sick and aging people that society might ever come to a point of encouraging your death, not just to end your suffering, but for the benefit of young, healthy people. And let's face it, for the money. Well, that is part of the framing of an all-day public event at NYU tomorrow called Love and Let Die, an all-day consideration of ballooning longevity, the quality of life, and the coming generational smash-up. So let's have a little bit of that conversation now with the organizer, Lawrence Weschler, director of the NYU Institute for the Humanities, and Dr. Diane Meyer, CEO of the Center to Advance Palliative Care and a physician and medical ethics professor at the Mount Sinai Medical Center. She has been a leader of the end-of-life palliative care movement, even winning a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2008. So, Lawrence Weschler, welcome back. Dr. Meyer, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
So the event is all day tomorrow at the Cantor Film Center, NYU, 36 East 8th Street. And, Ren Weschler, let me read for our listeners how you have framed this family meeting in your one-paragraph blurb that you sent us. Quote, "With increasing frequency, one hears stories of 60-year-olds having to cope with the excruciating medical extended lives of their ever more incapacitated 90-year-old parents. But look at the situation from the point of view of their 25-year-old children, trying to imagine what the world will be like when those same baby boom parents reach 90. We may well be approaching a situation in which we as a society will have to choose between living in a world where an 85-year-old is routinely granted 5 hip operations or one in which we can still afford, say, primary school." Wow. So to put it right out there, I'll just ask it, is this about money, the competition between Medicare and things like preschool?
I wouldn't put it that way. You don't have to go all the way to the edge of the science fiction world in which old people are being encouraged to die at a particular age. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about the common sense thing that we all have either experienced ourselves or know people who have experienced, which is the way in which the medical system today, and Diane can talk about this better than I can, basically tortures people for the last year of their life in many cases. And this is the sort of thing that an incredible amount of money is spent, and it's not as though it's making life better. And so for the quality of life is horrendous, and it would be interesting to be able to have a conversation about the good death.
But that's the old palliative care hospice movement conversation. When you frame it as a coming generational smash-up, do you see it headed in this other direction? I mean, it's not how people want to see their relationships, which, as your blurb suggests, encompasses all the generations within families. Do you see a generational smash-up, and is it about resources?
It's partly about resources, but it's more the other way around. I mean, this is a little bit like the argument where rich people say it's class warfare if you raise the issue. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that right now we as a society have decided to put tons of resources into the last year of people's lives so that we can torture them. And that may not be the right way to do it.
Dr. Meyer, we'll get your voice in here in just a second. But listeners, we're opening up the phones, and I wonder if we can get an intergenerational mashup, if not smashup, going here on the phones at 212-433-WNYC. And screeners, let's make sure we get some people from the different generations on our limited number of lines. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Are you the 60-year-old having to cope with the excruciating medically extended life of your ever more incapacitated 90-year-old parent? 212-433-9692. Are you their 25-year-old adult children trying to imagine what the world would be like when those same baby boom parents of your own reach 90? Are you the 85-year-old prepping for your fifth hip operation. That's not heart failure. Would you ever just decline to get treated? Maybe you're the one being asked for the greatest sacrifice in the framing of these questions. 212-433. All right, all our lines are already full. 212-433-9692. But I warn you, everybody, we're going to bump you if we're not getting generational diversity in this first series of calls. So we want to hear from everybody. Dr. Meyer, I've read some of your work as a leader in the palliative care movement. And I haven't come across anything that frames the movement as a duty to not treat because the end of life is more expensive to society than it's worth, only as a compassion movement to give pain relief and spiritual comfort and physical comfort to people close to death rather than painful medical intervention that doesn't much extend their lives anyway but does literally torture them, as Wren put it. But is it both?
No, it's not both. So I think we're running down, barking up the wrong tree here, shall we say. People are not living forever because we're torturing them with medical devices that are prolonging their life. They're living forever because they didn't die in childbirth or as infants because of basic public health measures. Life expectancy is growing because people are no longer dying during childbirth and early childhood, and in small part because there's less death due to cancer and heart disease. So that's why people live to extremes of old age. That's why we're seeing so much more dementia. That's why we're seeing so much more frailty and functional impairment. It's not because expensive medical treatments are in there dragging these miserable lives out. People are living. So the question is, what do we do with this success of modern public health and modern medicine, which is that people are living for a very long time? And I would argue it's not wrong to spend money on care of the sick. That's why we have a healthcare system, to care for the sick. The question is, how are we spending that money? Are we spending it in a way that really helps people have the best possible quality of life, or are we spending it in a way that just enriches certain elements of the healthcare system?
But President Obama, when preparing the country for his health reform bill, talked openly one time, you certainly remember this, about the very high percentage of our national medical dollars that we spend on the last few months of life. And he put into the Affordable Care Act the best practices review process for Medicare. And as we all know, that got attacked as death panels. But on some level, are we talking about death panels? And do we need to talk about death panels in a positive way if you're proposing not just individual choice, but a change in the routine practice of medicine?
This is a logical fallacy that somehow we know in advance who is going to die. We don't know. We know that very sick people need help, need medical care. We provide it. Some fraction of them do fine, get better. Some fraction of them don't. Only in retrospect can we say, oh, look how much money we spent in the last year of life. We don't have that luxury of seeing the future of who's in the last year of life. And what kind of healthcare system would we have if we didn't think that it was worthwhile to spend money on the care of the sick? That's the whole point of the healthcare system. And I think it's intellectually lazy to talk about wasted money at the end of life. I mean, this is why we have a healthcare system. The real question is, what are the ends of a society? What are the ends of medicine and serving the ends of a society? And it is the best possible quality of life.
So did President Obama mislead the country into an unproductive conversation by citing those stats? And I assume the stats are essentially true.
I think that he did, in the sense that if you yourself were diagnosed tomorrow with a serious cancer, would we say, well, your odds of dying are maybe 60% in the next year, so we're just not going to take care of you? Because that's as good as our prediction can be, but it's good enough, and it's a waste to spend money on someone who might be in the last year of life.
But it doesn't happen quite like that. I mean, I just lost my oldest relative a few weeks ago, a 98-year-old uncle, who died in Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx, and at some point a decision was made by his adult children to not have a surgery that would have been excruciating and expensive, though expensive did not cross their minds. It was covered. But it would have been excruciating, and it would have been expensive to somebody, maybe the taxpayers, for probably not much life extension at all. Mm-hmm. And instead they moved him into palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
An uncontroversial decision.
Absolutely.
But nevertheless, one they had to make because the surgery was being offered to them.
Well, again, here's a system where right now we pay doctors for volume. The more you do, the more you get paid. The more things that we do in the hospital, the more money the hospital makes. We have a system that is perfectly designed to get these results, and it's how we pay for medical care. We don't pay for high-quality support in the home and in the community. People end up in the emergency room and hospital because there is literally no alternative in the system. That's where the money's going.
Yeah, I just want to say that at the end of the day, this isn't the way we're framing the thing, isn't exactly about the money. This is about family conversations that need to take place. One of the ways we put this is we want to talk about lifelong family planning. In other words, you know, that family planning is something you do at the beginning of life and you do at the end of life. You know, and is it possible to provoke conversations within families when people are well about what their attitude is, right now, and to plan toward it? And we can't right now for some reason. We just can't have those conversations.
We're talking with Lawrence Wechsler from the NYU Humanities Institute and Dr. Diane Meyer from Mount Sinai and legendary at this point, promoter of the palliative care movement, winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant to do that, among other things, on this all-day symposium that they're going to have as part of the NYU Humanities Institute series tomorrow at the Cantor Film Center at NYU called Love and Let Die, an all-day consideration of ballooning longevity, the quality of life, and the coming generational smash-up. And Sam in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Sam.
Yeah, I'm 85.
Uh-huh.
I worked a whole lifetime. Let's say I had a family and I had kids and I raised them. I put them through college and all the rest of this stuff. And now, you know, when I'm not productive and they may be even able to clean up a little bit in what I may have made, knock them off, you know, because then the kids won't be able to get as much. You know, look, I thought this was a country for the individual. Yeah, let it be up to the individual as to whether or not he wants to live or not. How's that?
Dr. Maya?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that, and I agree with that. I mean, it is all about what matters to each individual person. And if you ask older people who are still independent but in senior centers or assisted living, what is most important to them? Their number one priority is independence, not being dependent on another person. Their number two priority is not suffering with pain and misery, not being tortured. And dead last, no pun intended, is staying alive. Do we have a healthcare system that honors those priorities? We do not. We have a healthcare system that is only focused on the third.
But then, and Sam, thank you for your call, and I hope you live a long and healthy life. Maybe I'm reading too much into the blurb, but the most ethically difficult part of the framing in the paragraph that you mm-hmm. sent us was about the 85-year-old. Mm-hmm. As I said, that's not heart failure when he is days from the end. You don't say the 85-year-old deciding whether to endure a fifth hip operation. You say the 85-year-old routinely granted five hip operations, mm-hmm. suggesting that someone has the power to grant him that operation or not.
Well, I mean, that comes back to the point about the health care system that encourages that. There's a whole industry encouraging that. But I guess I do want to emphasize that we are – I mean, for example, some of the kinds of things we're talking about in this event, Sharon Kaufman, who's a terrific anthropologist out of the University of California, San Francisco, wants to talk about this weird new phenomenon of kids giving their parents their kidneys, which is happening a lot and which is really weird if you think about it. I mean, this whole kind of thing. Mike Daisy is going to do an entire monologue on the kinds of stories that you were just having.
Mm-hmm.
But and then, by the way, one thing that is going to be wild is that Arthur Kaplan, who's the head of bioethics at Langone Center at NYU, is going to do was originally going to do a mock debate on whether the National Institutes of Health should be abolished. He was going to debate it with a friend of his who's a pharmacology guy.
Why? What would the argument for abolition
Because it just comes up with more and more things that extends people's lives into more and more, you know. He did it somewhat tongue-in-cheek. What was fascinating, by the way, is that the guy from the pharmaceutical industry was not allowed to participate. They wouldn't let him participate in the conversation. You have something to say about the National Institutes of Health, too.
Yeah, I mean, the National Institutes of Health, if you came down from Mars and you looked at the NIH, you could be forgiven for assuming that the NIH is about the defeat of death. that the goal of the NIH is to disease by disease eliminate death. And of course, as a society, we should reflect on whether that really is our goal as a society. What kind of society would it be if we eliminated death? Instead, the NIH should be focusing on what's a good life for people and investing money in maximizing quality of life for people as opposed to squeezing out another 3 months. So I wouldn't eliminate the NIH. I would refocus its priorities on things that matter to people.
Yeah. Christian in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Christian.
Yes, hello. I'm a first-time caller, and I'm an attorney. I'm 30 years old. And I just wanted to comment that we as a society already place a value on human life, especially in terms of wrongful death. And we actually don't grant that life much value. But then it seems that on the opposite side of the conversation, for perfectly acceptable spending vast sums of money prolonging a life, which it had been taken too quickly, we wouldn't be comfortable compensating the survivors or the estate or the family the same amount. So it seems that if we're comfortable on one end on placing a value on a life cut short that's very low, we should be comfortable having the conversation of how much that life is worth to keep going.
I guess one of the things, by the way, just my philosophy on these events that we've done, and I've been here several times, we were talking about solitary last time, is I like grabbing the third rail of any possible subject and then grabbing as many people as possible and seeing what happens. And in this particular case, the thing I really – if I came out of this, what I would love to have – the fact of the matter is we already do put monetary values on everything and we're already doing that. The question
whether we
is,
want to look that in the face or not.
Or not. And the question is, can we have that conversation as a society? Now, as families, it's a different conversation. And that, at the end of the day, is the real thing I want to see happen, is that we really should be able to have these conversations.
So on that point, let me bring in Kate, an ER nurse in South Amboy. Kate, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Well, what I see, and it's an interesting dynamic, is I often will have patients who come in, they're elderly, and if they're in like a cardiac arrest situation or they're in a life-threatening situation, the family members, well, oftentimes there's been no conversation. Or
exactly.
There's this one side of the family says, okay, they would have wanted, you know, everything done, or no, they wouldn't want anything done. And it really puts the medical community in, our hands are tied. So the physicians, they don't really have anything to go on unless there's a do not resuscitate order or an advance directive. And, you know, not all patients come to the hospital with that. And oftentimes, like I said, we're just kind of left there. And
what do you do? Are you trained now to help facilitate those conversations?
We do that a lot because we'll see how the patients are. And there's a terminology that we will use, like it's called circling the drain. And you just see the patient going down. And it's a situation where it's, they're probably not going to make it, and we'll pump them full of medications that will falsely elevate their blood pressures. But, you know, it's, you know, this patient's going to go into cardiac arrest, and to be pounding on the chest of an 80-year-old frail person who probably isn't going to make it, that's very traumatic. But we try to facilitate the conversation as nurses, you know, to ask them, you know, what would they want? Like, and give them an expectation of, you know, if we do get them back, they will be on a ventilator. We don't know if they're going to come off. What would they want? And give that time, that at that time, give it to the family to kind of sit down and talk to them. One of the things I find, and I work in two different facilities, two different hospitals, mm-hmm. in ER, is that there is not necessarily like a chaplain service or a grief service that's available 24/7 to kind of help people process what's going on. And I think that's where, you know, the nurses were kind of picking up that kind of slack.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not opposed to doing it because I've had two grandparents go through hospice. My father died at 62 with cancer, and when he did chemo, I couldn't believe they were doing it on him. It made no sense to me, but that was his choice. But, you know, the goal is not to give people false hopes, and to give them enough data where they can make that decision.
Kate, thank you very much. Such an important voice in this conversation.
So, yeah, that was very helpful, Kate. And nurses are the linchpin of compassionate care in our healthcare system. So thank you for your work. I think you're right that we do need to make routine the issue of talking about the what ifs, because the what if will happen to every one of us with 100% certainty. But in addition to talking about
what if and what when
is, it's not enough to get people's goals for care written down. It's not enough for them to say, I don't want these machines, when we have a system that only provides the machines. We have to be able to honor people's wishes and goals. And that means a wholesale shift of medical and taxpayer resources out of acute care hospitals, out of emergency rooms, and into communities where people can get the support they need to have an independent quality of life as long as possible in their home.
Also,
but right now, they can't get that.
Also, the advanced directives can't anticipate every situation.
Exactly.
Because I've seen a few now, and they're unique. Every single one is a little different. My
That's
uncle's
exactly.
case, what, you know, to make an incision to do something in the lung that I don't know,
right.
you know,
but,
and in somebody else's case, it's something else.
But yep. that's exactly the point. No advance directive can ever anticipate the nuances and the specificity of each individual situation. We need to have physicians, nurses, social workers, chaplains trained to come face-to-face with each individual situation and work it through in a respectful way that honors what's most important, what matters most to that person and their family. You cannot predict the future. Yeah. Yeah. You cannot plan for every eventuality.
And having said that, one of the things we're going to have tomorrow, some of your listeners may have heard the podcast on Radiolab where Jad Abumrad and his father and various doctors talked. It turns out that if you ask a question, do you want everything done for preservation of life, to the average population, 90% do. If you ask doctors, do they want CPR, do they want all these different things toward the end, 90% say no.
No, they're so horrible. They're not.
They know what it's like. Yeah.
Jad came on the show and talked about this too. They're not like they look on television.
We're going to have that. Yeah.
We're out of time except to say I want to acknowledge something about you, Ren, to the listeners and folks. You may know Lawrence Wechsler from his 20 years as a New Yorker correspondent or his books on subjects from torture to art. Now he is concluding a 12-year run as director of the NYU Institute for the Humanities, where he has held symposia and staged day-long or weekend-long public conversations on all manner of things, this year alone on Vermeer, human rights in the Arab Spring, solitary confinement, and coming tomorrow on this intergenerational smash-up about longevity. The series has produced some great programs here, as many of you know, because Ren has been generous enough to round up some of his best guests and bring them in for preview conversations like today's. But tomorrow is the end of his run. So just tell us, as a humanities guy in the broadest sense, meaning being concerned about humanity mm-hmm. from the medical to the ethical to the aesthetic, mm-hmm. did you make this project sing the way you had hoped?
I love doing this stuff. I mean, you know, I bring it to my writing too. I've been writing all along as well, but it does seem to me that live conversation of people in face-to-face encounters is what this is all about. And you can, you know, on our website, nyihumanities.org, you can look at some of the we do video of a lot of these things, and they're really moving. There's some incredibly moving things. For me, it's been very, very rewarding.
And Dr. Meyer,
can I just say, live conversation face to face between real human beings is what we need in medical care as well.
The event is called Love and Let Die, an all-day consideration of ballooning longevity, the quality of life, and the coming generational smash-up at the Cantor Film Center tomorrow on East 8th Street. What does all day mean? When do you start?
We're going to start at 11, and we have it's designed for people to come in and go out. Go and look at our website. You can see what the schedule is. But we're going to have these different sorts of things with Mike Daisy at 6:30, and by the end of the thing, we're going to have a conversation about what a good death would be like for people just in the audience to talk about that too.
Free to the public?
Free to the public, as always.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, sports and politics, from ancient Greece to Adolf Hitler to Muhammad Ali to Jason Collins, you know that name yet, to today's front page of the New York Times about Rutgers. Stay with us.